I think I've always been a very sensitive person. I'm also the oldest in my family, and so I've had kind of personality tendencies, like I'm a perfectionist. There's been anxiety and depression within my family.
You may be surprised to hear that the condition this woman is trying to understand is an eating disorder. Our health reporting unit, the Heartland Health Monitor, has been looking into efforts to reopen a clinic for eating disorders in the Kansas City area. The one we had closed 2 years ago, and we don't currently have a facility for inpatient treatment. I'm Gina Kaufman. On today's show, we're going to discuss the causes of and treatments for eating disorders. We'll start by getting back to the woman we just heard from. Her recovery took place at a facility in Denver. Nadia Hassana has the story.
Eating disorders affect over 11 million women and men in the United States. Anorexia, bulimia, and other non-specified disorders can be life-threatening and plague children and adults of all ages. That's according to the Eating Recovery Center of Denver, a behavioral hospital specializing in the treatment of eating disorders. Megan Bremen is a recovered patient who spent 2 months in partial hospitalization care at the center during the summer of 2010 and continues outpatient counseling.
Every day I would go into work and I wouldn't, you know, eat all day. And then at night I would be so hungry that I would binge. And then the next day I would punish myself by restricting all day.
Bremen suffered from anorexia and non-purging bulimia from the time she was 18 until she was nearly 30.
It felt much more comfortable in my body because I wouldn't have to feel my body if I wasn't eating. The binges would happen, you know, physiologically because I would be starving, but I think also I would be upset about something or I would be overwhelmed. Initially, I would be feeling overwhelming feelings that felt out of control and it felt too much to feel. And then as soon as I would binge during, I would feel this, you know, overwhelming sense of relief and pleasure. And then my feelings would quickly change to being upset with myself that I ate too much. So the feelings would just be transferred from something that was out of my control to something that I could then come up with a plan tomorrow. I'm going to change. I'm never going to do this again.
An eating disorder is a predisposition. It's a genetic predisposition.
Enola Gorham is the clinical program director at the Eating Recovery Center.
Most people with eating disorders are struggling with depression and or anxiety, and for whatever reason, the restricting of food or the binging of food, this has to do with how you're wired or predisposed, is the thing that helps you feel better.
Is a person ever completely cured or completely free of an eating disorder?
The vast majority of people with eating disorders have full recovery.
I think something I'm very passionate about as far as recovery is that it's a very complex disorder. There's many things that contributed to my eating disorder. I think I've always been a very sensitive person. I'm also the oldest in my family, and so I've had kind of personality tendencies, like I'm a perfectionist. There's been anxiety and depression within my family, so I think those things contributed as well.
Education and knowledge is a key piece in recovery, so it's very important to work with a professional. I'll often meet with adult women who, when they were growing up, nobody even diagnosed this. So maybe they're only getting their treatment for the first time many, many years down the line.
My age now is 48, and my eating disorder, bulimia, started when I was about 17 or 18.
Karen Imber had bulimia for 30 years before growing through 8 months of inpatient treatment last year. Can you tell me how dramatically did having bulimia for 30 years affect your life? Were you able to have a family, have consistent relationships?
I basically put all my energy into making sure that the outside world did not have a clue that I had an eating disorder, but on the inside, I really suffered. I basically a year ago had planned and started executing on a suicide plan. You know, the depression was a big piece of my problem as well, and the eating disorder helped manage that. It was almost like I was using the eating disorder to try to become absolutely as sick as possible in hopes that my heart would stop one night. I walk away now being able to say, I actually do have values. I also walk away understanding that I don't need to be ashamed of this. This is very genetically based. And that I was born with a certain temperament or hardwiring. some really learned to accept myself and turn to my values when I start thinking about possibly having eating disorder behaviors and ask myself, you know, if I have this behavior, how does that support my values?
How is your life different now after going through treatments?
I feel like I'm able to be more present in my life. The feelings are reasonable, and I can name the feelings, and I can, you know, take the power away from them, and I can understand that they're going to pass. They don't have to control me. I can just, you know, feel them, and then they pass, and then I feel okay. My relationship with food has shifted dramatically, and I guess what's amazed me the most is that I had all these things that I would secretly love, but I would never allow myself, you know, sweets, of those types of things. And now I allow myself whatever I want, and I don't want them. I mean, I have them sometimes, but they don't have the power that they used to have.
That story comes to us from Nadia Hassana of station KGNU in Denver. There's a lot to unpack in that story. And for that, let's turn now to Dr. Ashley McCune, who's here in the live studio this morning. She comes to us from Insight, a counseling center that specializes in eating disorders. Welcome to Central Standard, Ashley.
Hi, thanks for having me.
A lot of people probably think eating disorders are about body image or cosmetic concerns, and we really didn't hear a thing about that just now. We heard instead about being in and out of control, about facing challenges with depression. What is known about the causes of eating disorders?
Well, the thing that's known about the causes of eating disorders is that it's very complex and it's multi-layered. But the biggest thing to consider is the genetic component. You really can't talk about eating disorders without looking at that piece. There are studies that show us that eating disorders are even more genetically heritable than IQ.
That's really interesting. I mean, do parents of people who have eating disorders or grandparents tend to recognize a relationship with this illness in themselves when they hear about it?
Sometimes, yeah, absolutely. But oftentimes, you know, when I see an individual, they're seeking treatment for the first time. You know, they may have struggled in the past, maybe the parent, but they're seeing these behaviors come out in their child, and then they're seeking treatment for the first time.
That's really – so that it's genetic is really surprising to me.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk more about how we know that and how we've come to understand that?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's been many studies that look at just the link between parental diagnosis or behaviors and then that coming out in, you know, their offspring. In addition, there's been twin studies that show the genetic component as well. And then again, you know, also what's genetically predisposed is anxiety. That's very hardwired into somebody's temperament. And so when you see somebody who has an eating disorder, you're almost always going to see that there is some depression or some anxiety or both going on at the same time.
When people talk about the importance of healthy, positive body image, particularly for adolescent girls, is that at all relevant to this discussion or is that a separate important conversation?
I think both are true. Body image is absolutely something that we focus on in treatment, and it's something that I think is important for all people to really pay attention to. So, you know, usually how an eating disorder starts is these concerns or these thoughts about body. So that's kind of like the base of where things begin.
Like a trigger for the rest of it?
Mm-hmm. And so an individual will start to have these thoughts or beliefs about their own body. They'll have a lot of comparison going on, but they'll always be able to pinpoint it back to when those thoughts started to begin. And that happens way sooner than any sort of behavior typically. And then once things progress, it turns into more behavioral things that we see. So I always think of it kind of like an iceberg. You know, the tip of the iceberg is what we see going on with the behaviors. But underlying all of that are body image concerns and then also the temperament issues that happen. You know, people with eating disorders tend to be a little bit driven, perfectionistic. You know, they're the person that you want as a student because they're always going to get their homework done. They're going to get straight A's. They work so hard. They're harder on themselves than they are on anybody, you know, that anybody else could be on them. They're so, so driven and so intelligent typically.
What are some of the main things we're talking about when we're talking about eating disorders? Can you outline some of the most common eating disorders and the thoughts and behaviors that characterize them?
Sure. So anorexia nervosa is an eating disorder that is characterized by typically a low body weight, although the DSM-5 has removed that diagnostic criteria.
And that's the manual that professionals use to diagnose.
Yes. And so it's characterized by a pretty severe restriction of caloric intake, lots of rules and rigidity around food. And you'll see body weight typically start to decline. You know, I think that story before I mentioned that somebody could drop, you know, to about 50% of ideal body weight and, of course, need pretty significant medical stabilization and refeeding. That can be seen with purging behaviors as well. So the primary diagnostic criteria is the restriction, though, and we can see it with purging behaviors.
So that's anorexia nervosa.
Mm-hmm. Bulimia nervosa is characterized by distinct periods of binge eating that occur a couple times a week, and it's been ongoing for, you know, several months. And then the compensatory behaviors that come after the binging include self-induced vomiting, over-exercise, any way to get rid of that binge or that those food calories that they've consumed.
So are there any others that we should be thinking about? Those are probably the most well-known, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there is one more that is called binge eating disorder. So in the DSM-5, so in the manual that we use, this is just released, and it is its own separate diagnosis at this point. Previous to this manual, it was not, which really left a lot of people thinking that they didn't have a real disorder, and it limited how much treatment they could access. So binge eating disorder is very similar to bulimia nervosa. It just doesn't include the compensatory behaviors of vomiting, overexercise, things like that.
So how dangerous are these illnesses?
They're very dangerous. Particularly anorexia and bulimia nervosa, they can have severe medical consequences. You know, when a person's weight drops below a certain point, the body starts to turn on itself and start to get the nutrients it needs. And it starts to go after muscle. And eventually, a body will go after heart muscle. And so it's very, very dangerous. In addition, you know, there can be a loss of period if we're talking about a female. That has huge impacts on their fertility in the future, their growth, depending on how old they are when they get the eating disorder. Bulimia nervosa also has really serious consequences. Electrolytes can become so compromised based on how much a person is binging and purging that, you know, their potassium levels can become unstable and they can absolutely have a heart attack and die.
How common is true sustained recovery?
I mean, I believe that the majority of people can be recovered from this. There are a percentage of people that will struggle and just kind of need treatment throughout their life. And there's nothing wrong with that. But sometimes symptoms stay present. And then there are a certain amount of people that do not recover from eating disorders. And this is a disorder that has the highest mortality rate associated with it. So the highest mental health diagnosis, the mental health diagnosis was the highest mortality rate associated.
Wow. Well, we're joined also this morning by John Smith, who is in the process of recovering from an eating disorder. He's graciously agreed to share what he's going through with us. Hi, John. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me your story. When do you think it all began?
I think my relationship with food started changing when I was in fourth or fifth grade. I was a little heavier and I was teased at school, and I was my eating habits were pointed out at home, and I kind of just combined everything and thought if I changed the way I look and the way that I'm perceived by other people, then I'd kind of fix everything.
Do you recognize a lot of the other things that that Ashley was just describing, like being very driven and wanting to accomplish a lot, being, you know, basically what people would call a good kid?
Yeah, definitely. And I was always a really big perfectionist and struggled with OCD and always really driven in school, and academics has always been the one thing that like really drove me. But yeah, I agreed with a lot of what she had to say.
So how did this realization in your mind, this feeling that you could change your life by dropping pounds, how did that start influencing your behavior?
Well, I started changing the way I ate and started eating healthier and cutting out sweets and I was exercising more and trying to feel better about myself in that regard. And that just kind of started a whole like whirlwind, and I started cutting out more foods and exercising more, and then it just became really, really restrictive by the time I was in high school.
When you say really restrictive, can you tell us a little bit more about exactly what you mean by that?
I mean, there are different periods of times that like my restriction kind of manifested differently, but I was always told myself that there were foods that I couldn't have and that there were like safe foods. And for me, that always meant cutting out sweets and fats and stuff that I knew were kind of more unhealthy or perceived to be more unhealthy. And I was vegetarian most recently when I was admitted to inpatient treatment, and I was just very, very restrictive in how vegetarian I was, and there were even very limited things that I ate at one time. So,
when did it get to a point that you or someone close to you recognized that there was a problem, that you weren't just a kid who had taken on some healthy habits, you know?
Yeah. Well, for me, I had friends like in freshman and sophomore year of high school that kind of asked if I had eating disorders, or I kind of joked about it in a way to kind of make it aware that like what I was doing was weird. But I didn't really realize that I was doing anything wrong until it was after my sophomore year of high school, and my weight dropped to below what I weighed in fifth grade, which I had in my mind as like kind of fixing everything.
Oh, because fifth grade, that's around where people were making fun of you.
Yeah.
Aww.
So I had that weight in my head, and I kind of thought if I got below that weight, then I would be happy with everything and everything would be A-okay. But
you had presumably grown quite a bit in height since fifth grade.
Yes.
Oh, that's really heartbreaking. So when did the joking, I mean, it sounds almost kind of cruel that joking was a way of trying to communicate to you that maybe you had a problem. Did that hurt your feelings, or did it really signal to you that maybe it was time to seek help?
No, it didn't really make me think that I needed to get help. I just kind of liked that they thought I was skinny and that they thought I was healthy with what I was eating. And when I was in college, a lot of people made comments about how thin I was, especially other guys, but it was a lot of the comments were reassuring about like how healthy I was eating and how much I was running.
So like insult compliments?
Kind of at times.
So how much were you running and how much were you eating? Can you kind of give us the picture here?
Well, before I went to treatment this past time, I was running at least 12 miles and up to 20, sometimes more than that, miles a day.
Did anyone ever encourage you to run less, to do this less? Did you ever try to stop on your own outside of treatment?
Stop on my own? I think there were times that I knew like what I was doing was kind of like excessive, but the only time I was ever really told to run less was I was out running one day and I coughed up blood and I had to go to a doctor, and obviously, and he told me to not run for 2 weeks to kind of like let my body heal, and like because I've been putting it through so much, and I was told not to run for 2 weeks, and I think I lasted 2 days. So
what was going through your head during those 2 days? Like what ended up making it inconceivable to go the full 2 weeks?
Oh, well, I didn't think that if I couldn't run, then I didn't think I could eat. And like in those 2 days, I was trying to think of any other way that I could compensate for and to like burn more calories without running. So,
John, can we come right back to your story after the station break?
Sure.
Central Standard will return shortly. We'll hear about the steps John has taken to recover from his eating disorder, and we'll learn more about the various treatment options out there. We'll want to hear from you, too. Don't go away. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this morning we're talking about eating disorders, what we know about them, and paths to recovery. Have eating disorders affected you or your family? If so, what have been your most surprising, most helpful realizations? Call us to talk about it. The number is 816-235-2888. That number again is 816-235-2888. And while you're calling in, let's turn back to John Smith, who was just sharing us his own story about struggling with eating disorders. And John, do you have a particular diagnosis that you're comfortable sharing?
I was diagnosed with anorexia, and more specifically purge type anorexia, in which I overcompensated for the calories that I did intake by exercising.
What has worked for you treatment-wise? I mean, you've described a situation where even with a doctor telling you to stop running and you were coughing up blood, like, you still felt compelled to persist, to reduce your caloric intake, to lose more weight. What shifted your thinking?
I was in treatment once in high school, and that just didn't really stick, really.
How did you end up in treatment in high school?
My weight dropped to below what it was when I was seeing my dietitian. I had seen her for about a year, and my weight had dropped consistently for a little while, and she kind of gave me an ultimatum of either like really kicking it up and doing better on my own or getting more help. And I was actually at Vita in Kansas City for about a month.
So can you tell us what Vita was?
It was an inpatient facility and research medical center, and it helped, it provided treatment for eating disorders to those in the area. And, it was a smaller program of about, I think, 16 beds were available, but it was 24-hour care at the hospital.
What was it about? Was there something about 24-hour care that provided a resource that you couldn't get if you were going home and returning to your own environment?
It took away the ability to, like, act on behaviors for the most part. I mean, people find ways to act on behaviors when you're in treatment, but...
Like what?
Well, the second time I was in treatment, I got caught for exercising in my room. And, I mean, there's things that happen in treatment if you're not really ready to kind of let go of those behaviors and really face the recovery process.
Ashley McCune from Insight Counseling Center, what are you hearing in what John's saying? Is there anything that's really resonating with you that you can extrapolate some general insights from?
Sure. You know, what I hear, you know, you saying is that, especially with your development of your eating disorder, nobody ever starts out with the intention of developing an eating disorder. It develops slowly and gradually. You know, behaviors kind of start and then they get gradually worse until the point where they're just so far gone that some people are starting to notice, they're making comments, and then they're encouraging you to get treatment. So it's important to watch those warning signs before somebody's weight is, you know, really, really dropping.
For a person who has a friend or relative who is showing signs that they're concerned about, And maybe in a lot of cases you would look at something and not quite be sure whether this was just a person being extra healthy or a person being in many ways the opposite. Mm-hmm. What do you recommend? I mean, are there things to say and do and things to definitely avoid saying and doing?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would definitely recommend talking to that individual in a caring, supportive way, saying things like, I notice that you're doing this. I'm concerned that this is going on. Instead of swooping in and trying to give directives, you know, you really need to stop doing that. That's not okay. Because that doesn't at all get at what that person is actually struggling with.
And it seems like it could really provoke a feeling of not being good enough or of failing at something, which seems to be kind of part of the underlying issue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What about you, John? Did people
say or do things with all the best intentions that just didn't work? And if so, can you explain how those things actually made you feel?
Well, I had friends that were kind of just always telling me that they were there if I needed to talk. And those were the friends that I found most helpful. And when I realized and accepted that I had an eating disorder, they were the first ones that I told. And then I had people that told me I just needed to eat and it would be fine. And I had people that were persistently trying to be there for me. And it wasn't until I was ready for them to kind of be there that their help was actually needed or wanted by me. But I don't know, I think there's a lot of stuff that is not helpful to say to someone that has an eating disorder. And it's hard to really think about how they're going to perceive your help. But I agree with what Ashley says. And I think just saying that you're there, like when they need to talk, and saying that you have concern and not trying to fix it for them. Cause it takes a lot of willingness on the person that's suffering on their part to want to get the help.
John, is there anything that you've learned in the process of recovery that you think is applying in positive ways to other areas of your life?
Oh, well, I'm sure I've learned a lot in this past year of the recovery that I've been doing best in. I'd say allowing myself to, or trying not to like be so hard on myself in all aspects of life, because I was very competitive in nature with my eating disorder and thought that if I was going to do it, I had to do it at the best that I could. But I mean, they say that like the best anorexic is the one that dies from it, because like you're so obsessed with it. So I think allowing myself that grace to kind of just take things as they come and accept that like I'm not going to be the best at everything, but the best thing I can do is like the next right thing. That's been very helpful.
So like the distinction between the right thing and the best thing.
Yeah.
What's been the hardest thing to deal with in the recovery process?
Finding new ways to deal with stressors and anxiety and the different emotions that I didn't really let myself feel for so long.
Dr. Ashley McCune of Insight Counseling Center, what are your thoughts on that, on dealing with some of the underlying problems?
Mm-hmm. It's one of the huge focuses in treatment is to help an individual disentangle themselves from their eating disorder behaviors and learn to deal with those things in their life that do cause stress, that do cause anxiety, just in a healthier way. A lot of that involves learning how to tolerate stress and just find different coping mechanisms.
What has changed in recent years when it comes to diagnosis and understanding and treating eating disorders? Is there new research or new information that is shifting the thoughts about this?
Yeah, I mean, there's new research all the time. Especially in assessment and diagnosis and treatment. So we're continually looking at things that are going to improve outcomes. So as of right now, there aren't really any empirically based treatments for anorexia nervosa.
Really? That's surprising.
Mm-hmm. There are for bulimia nervosa, but the research field is dedicated to finding methods that are empirically validated. So that means supported by science. Now, there are treatments available that do improve. I'm not saying that there aren't treatments available, but that much more needs to be done in the field as well.
One thing that I think would be really challenging about this is that you have to eat. You have to. So unlike someone who struggles with some kind of feature of their environment that is optional, like you can just say, I will not drink if I have a problem with alcohol, for example. I mean, that's not a simple process by any means, but mm-hmm. there is something that can just strictly be removed from your life. But someone who is struggling with an eating disorder has to face food ideally, you know, 3 times a day or so.
Mm-hmm.
John, how is that for you? I mean, you can't just ignore this.
No, but it's one of those things that it does get easier. And one of the things that makes it easier is through the refeeding process, like regaining those hunger signals.
Explain the refeeding process.
Well, like when I was first checked into inpatient, they start you on a feeding plan that reintroduces food to your diet, basically. And depending on like where you are in your disorder, and like for me, I was started out on very little portions because I didn't want to refeed too quickly because that poses its own issues medically. But so they reintroduce food slowly and try to regulate your appetite and regain those hunger signals, which has been like being able to feel hungry again is different, but it makes the eating part a lot easier.
There's such a prevalent idea out there, and I'd like both of you to respond to this, that being restrictive with food and losing weight are positive things. It's actually kind of frustrating just as an observer that not everyone should lose weight. Not everyone should be on a diet. But you wouldn't know it from the messages out there in our grocery stores, on our television shows, on magazine covers. When you have to – do you, Ashley, have to work against a whole world of messaging when working with your clients? Because early on anyway, I'm guessing that people congratulate them because losing weight in our society is seen as a universal positive.
Right. And that's absolutely true. And this is one of the reasons why it's so complex when we're thinking about the development of eating disorders, because we live in a culture that values weight loss, values quick, instant gratification. And so, you know, just like we were talking about, when you would get those positive comments, when you would, you know, if someone noticed a weight loss, the eating disorder takes that and is just so reinforced by it. And so behaviors then will increase as a result.
John, do you have to tune out a lot of that messaging or just learn to let it roll off your back?
It's taken a lot of just kind of redefining what I think like happiness with like my own body is. And I'm still struggle a lot with eating body image. But I think, yeah, there are a lot of messages that can be misconstrued. And for me, a lot of it was everything that I was doing was perceived as like healthy for other people. Like they told me that they wish they could eat as healthy as I did or run as much as I did. So it is perceivably like okay for other people.
Central Standard is going to take a very short break. We'll return to this conversation about understanding and recovering from eating disorders in a few. Call us with your insights. The number is 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. Here we are again. You're listening to a conversation about eating disorders on Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, joined in the studio by Dr. Ashley McCune of Insight Counseling Center and John Smith, who's a patient in recovery. And John, that language, in recovery, do you think that the distinction between being in recovery and having recovered, where do you see that line? Do you see recovery as something in your future, or do you see this as even if you're doing well at a time, this is something you'll need to remain aware of and vigilant about?
I definitely think I think recovery is possible, but I think it's going to be an ongoing process for me personally. I think there's always going to be something that reminds me of my eating disorder, and there's going to be times that there's stressful situations and my instinct is, oh, I need to run or I need to restrict. And I've only really been in recovery for the past like year and a half, but I think it's always going to be something that I have to stay vigilant about and stay aware of, because they have a way of working themselves back in and grabbing back hold. So
you mentioned that part of what you're doing is trying to develop new ways of coping with stress, and that's been a real challenge. Is there something that you found that's starting to work?
I really have enjoyed yoga and activity that kind of helps calm me down and not just numb me out. So I've done that, and reading and listening to music and actually spending time with my friends has been really reinforcing of my recovery.
With so much socializing centered around food in our culture, is that sort of a double-edged sword?
Yeah, I avoided a lot of it when I was in my disorder and avoided. I didn't like family gatherings because everything was centered around food. A lot of things are celebrated with food. I missed out on a lot of opportunities and a lot of experiences because of my eating disorder, because I couldn't allow myself to partake in that.
Dr. Ashley McCune, the perception out there, I think, is that eating disorders are most relevant to young women. Obviously, we're sitting here with a man who's talking about his own recovery from an eating disorder. So at least that's not entirely accurate. But what is the relationship between gender and eating disorders?
Well, the relationship seems to be that it's a disorder that affects mostly women, but that does not mean that it doesn't affect men. And I think that we don't have an accurate representation of how much it affects men, because oftentimes, well, first of all, you have to consider that eating disorders thrive in secrecy and privacy, and people do everything they can, if they don't want treatment, to not let somebody know that they have it. And so then if you categorize eating disorders as a female disorder, that puts even more pressure on a male to not come forward that they're struggling. So I don't even think we have an accurate idea of how much men struggle with this.
John, has being a man made confronting your eating disorder challenging in any particular ways, having to do with ideas about masculinity and who suffers from this kind of thing?
Definitely. It was a lot of the reason why it took me a lot longer to accept that I had an eating disorder. And it's always been something that, well, at first it was something just added to the guilt that I felt, because I felt like it was emasculating, and I felt like it was saying something about me personally, about like why I was struggling with something that I was told only girls struggled with. But it's taken me a lot of time to kind of accept that it's not just a female disease, and that it is something that I have seen other men infected by.
Let's turn to our callers, because we've got some people who want to join this conversation. I'd like to speak with Christina in Lawrence. Hi, Christina.
Hi, how are you?
Great. How about you?
I'm doing really well, thanks.
What can you share with us?
Well, first of all, I really want to thank you guys for bringing this topic up. I struggled with bulimia when I was in high school and college, and I'm 29 now, so it's been a while since I've really been in the thick of it, and we've gained a lot of knowledge on the subject in the last 10 years or so, but it's still, especially by society at large, it's such a misunderstood sort of section of mental health disorders, and so much more needs to be done to educate the public about it. And so I really want to thank you guys for bringing it up. And then the other thing that I wanted to kind of touch on is, and you guys hit on it yourselves, was how validating it is when you have an eating disorder to constantly get compliments about how skinny you're getting. And because when I started struggling with bulimia, was overweight. And by the time I actually sought treatment, I was close to my ideal weight. I was a little bit under, but so for me, I never got to the kind of scary weight part of it.
But the behaviors themselves were dangerous regardless.
Oh, of course. Of course. I certainly didn't do it in a healthy way, but I hit it so well that my friends didn't recognize that I had a problem. They just saw, oh, Christina's, you know, getting to a healthier weight. And I think a large part of what adds to the struggle for people who are going through this is, you know, there's so much fat shaming in society, and everybody focuses on skinny instead of healthy. And so when you do lose weight, it's not looked at as a problem if they don't know how you're doing it, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. It does. Let's talk to our guests about that, that confluence in our language between weight loss and healthy, you know, like that something that the word healthy is something that people have started to use to mean this will make you lose weight, not to mean something about a bigger picture.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the reality is that somebody can be very healthy in their body and not be this, you know, ideal body weight. And just like you can be very thin and not be healthy. So the focus, especially when it comes to exercise, is often about, well, I just need to burn calories. I need to change my shape to look better. It doesn't have the focus of, I need to make my body healthy. I need to make my heart stronger. So oftentimes what I'm working on with individuals is, how do I disentangle this relationship with exercise and, you know, this perception that it's meant to burn calories and that it needs to shape my body in a different way.
And what about this issue of fat shaming that she mentioned?
Oh, it's pervasive in our society. People are judged so much by their outward appearance and their weight and shape, even by, you know, sometimes their medical doctors. You know, there was just a study released about weight shaming. So if a if a person experienced weight shaming by their physician.
How does this happen in the context of a physician's office?
Something like, well, you really need to lose weight. You know, you're quite overweight. Not coming in at them in a compassionate, caring way. You know, implying that that means anything negative about them. So if they perceive that, they are actually much less likely to lose weight in the future than they are compared to a patient that didn't experience that weight shaming.
Let's talk to Charlotte in Kansas City, who's called us. Hi, Charlotte.
Hello.
What can you add to this conversation we're having?
Well, I also wanted to thank you guys for addressing this topic. It's just so important, and I have struggled with an eating disorder for a long time, like 7 years, 8 years. I don't even know anymore. I am, you know, in the process of recovery, and I've been in different treatment centers and stuff throughout the country. And it is a very long process indeed. And I appreciate that you all are addressing so many different aspects of it. And the fact that it's not merely, about body image and appearance. And, something that I did want to kind of emphasize was that in many of the treatment centers that I have been to and the people that I've met along the way, that often people who struggle with eating disorders do not appear as though they do in that typical sort of like underweight, waifish look, and that often people can just look completely normal. There can be you can be overweight, you can be underweight, you can be normal looking. And I know that your previous caller kind of addressed that in her experience, and that you can be suffering silently inside, just so very, very severely, and not look like it on the outside. So that's just kind of what I wanted to bring up too, that like it's not just this physical thing. It's totally internal.
Thank you, Charlotte. This idea that people believe they can see an eating disorder. Mm-hmm. Can you comment on that, Ashley?
Yeah. One thing I did want to mention as well, though, is that an individual who has an eating disorder, if you ask them to rank on like a scale of 1 to 10, how much they think about food, their body, calories. If they are really, really struggling and not in recovery, most individuals will rank that 9, 10. So that's 100%, 90 to 100% of their day is spent thinking about this kind of thing. It's perceived that if you're a normal weight or even if you're overweight, that you don't really have an issue. So again, it's adding that shame factor to those individuals that aren't significantly underweight. Well, you don't really need treatment. You're just fine.
It seems like our use of language can play into this too, because I've heard the term anorexic used to just describe someone who is extremely thin and perhaps unattractively thin, and to be used disparagingly that way. Do we need more information and sensitivity around our use of particularly that term?
Mm-hmm.
John, do you hear that term being used in a way that affects you?
Oh, yeah. And it was, I was told like when I was very thin that I looked anorexic. I mean, they were right. But it's always kind of been used just kind of offhand. And I don't think really people think about how that word affects other people and really the consequences and the side effects of like actually struggling with an eating disorder, that they just kind of throw it around haphazardly.
Ashley, one of the things that did inspire this conversation is that there are efforts right now to open an inpatient treatment facility. And one thing that it seems like removing a person from their home, particularly an adolescent person from the home, would leave out of the picture potentially is the family dynamic. Mm-hmm. How important is a family dynamic in all of this?
Family is especially when we're talking about an adolescent, it's very important. you know, parenting a child with an eating disorder is difficult, and it requires oftentimes help from professionals to best do that. You know, it doesn't come with a handbook. So you need the help of a therapist and a dietitian and possibly even a family counselor to help guide you in that process.
I want to hear a little more about the roles of both of these figures, both the dietitian and the family counselor. Let's start with the dietitian.
Mm-hmm. The dietitian offers nutritional counseling, and it's not a standard what people think where you go to the dietitian and they just throw a meal plan at you. That's not what this person does. It's about redeveloping your relationship with food, you know, taking away the rules, the good and the bad, increasing flexibility, and of course, if it's needed, weight restoration.
Could that be in a way like replacing the rule of restricting with a rule of not having rules?
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's really interesting. John, did you go through a process like this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm still having to work on allowing myself to eat, like not having foods that are off limits. I've done a lot better lately, but I've seen the same dietitian since I started getting treatment and fostering that relationship. She knows that there's a lot of foods that that I would never allow myself to have. And she basically told me, like, I'm at this point where nothing is off limits, and it's about, just because I eat it once doesn't mean I have to eat it all the time. So you have that one meal and it's over. You don't have to have that every single day for the rest of your life. But taking that fear away and the power away from that food.
Ashley, what about the family therapy piece of it that you just mentioned? The family counselor.
Mm-hmm. The family counselor, that's not always needed. But when it is needed, it's very helpful in just supporting the family in their child's recovery, because the parents need to be that person for their adolescent that is supportive and loving and carries them through that process. And a lot of times the treatment team then needs to come in and be the person that's doing the guiding and kind of setting the rules, offering that guidance with the meal plan, things like that. So it removes the parent from that role in a way and lets the treatment team kind of manage that for them. And then they support the treatment team's recommendations, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. The things you mentioned earlier, things having to do with perfectionism, being driven, high achieving, smart individuals who are very susceptible to this. What about counseling the family to remove some of those pressures? Is that usually part of the treatment?
It can be, absolutely. And remember, the child is often, or not the child, the adolescent is often the person, they're very self-driven. So this may not even be coming, you know, from the parents. It may just be all from the adolescent. So it's about how helping that adolescent or young adult relax their kind of perfectionistic tendencies.
We heard a little bit earlier in the show about that the understanding of this has changed so much over the past decades that someone who has been suffering for a long time might only now be getting a diagnosis much later in life. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing our increase in understanding improving the health of people who suffer from these disorders in general, or is that not yet having an effect that you can look out there and see?
I don't know that I have a great answer for that. I think that when an individual gets a little bit of information that they may have something going on, and the quicker that they seek treatment, the better their outcome is going to be. The individuals that have a significant period of time between onset of symptoms and entering treatment have poorer outcomes.
We have a caller who we sadly don't have time to actually turn to, but she has a question about the difficulty of admitting you have a problem. John, maybe could you talk about that?
It was a very difficult process. It was something that I kind of knew what I was doing was wrong, and that it wasn't healthy for me and it wasn't what I should be doing. But it was really defeating to kind of accept that I had an eating disorder, because it kind of made me realize that, like, what I was doing was not wasn't as good as I thought it was, and that I could be hurt from it.
Are you glad now that you did admit it and that you're here on the radio talking about it?
Definitely. I'm very glad, and I'm very grateful for my friends that kind of gave me that push to accept it.
That's all the time we have for today's conversation about eating disorders. Thanks so much to our guests. Dr. Ashley McCune of Insight, you have been so informative. It's been great having you here.
Thank you.
And John Smith, thanks for opening up to our listeners today. Best of luck to you in your recovery. We're all rooting for you.
Thank you.
To listen back to today's show, just go to kcur.org/centralstandard later today. Sign up for our podcast while you're there. And don't forget, you can stay current on our news by following us on Twitter. Our handle is @KCURCST. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. Thanks to the Heartland Health Monitor for the reporting that prompted today's show. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's it for today. Stick around for Up to Date next.